Hi, welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. It is Wednesday, March 22nd, and I'm Jessica Steinberg. I'm joined today by U.S. correspondent Jacob Magid and New York reporter Luke Tress. Hello to you both.
Hi, Jessica.
Hey, Jessica.
Hey. So as the tug of war continues over the coalition's continued push for the judicial overhaul and the growing opposition to it, we'll talk about what the protests look like in New York, as well as what President Joe Biden is concerned about regarding the reform. There's also a diplomatic brouhaha with Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich and the Kingdom of Jordan, discussions in Sharm el-Sheikh ahead of Ramadan, and ice cream company Ben & Jerry's, which is being sued for child labor. Before we jump into all of that, let's hear a quick word from our sponsor.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
Jacob, get us started and tell us what Bezalel Smotrich just returned from New York, then in Paris, what he said that really angered the Jordanians.
Right. So it was kind of a disastrous visit to the U.S. that he had a week ago. He didn't really have any meetings with officials because the U.S. government largely boycotted him. The only people he met with were Israeli officials. And then he went and spoke at the Israel Bonds conference and was mocked for his English, and hundreds of people protested outside. It's not a great visit, so I think he was hoping to head to Paris for a more substantial set of meetings, but this too did not really take place. He spoke at this private memorial event for a late Likud activist on Sunday, and in this speech, he chose to stick to Hebrew this time, but he said that the Palestinians are an invention from the last century, claiming that his ancestors are the real Palestinians, that there's no Palestinian culture, and said they invent a fictitious people in the land of Israel and claim fictitious rights in the land of Israel to fight the Zionist movement. And he said all of that while standing behind a podium with a map of Greater Israel that includes within it the borders of modern-day Jordan. So this fiercely angered Amman, which issued a quick condemnation on Monday, both for the flag and then also for the comments that Smotrich made. Israeli Foreign Minister rushed to tweet in English and in Hebrew that it respects Jordan's territorial integrity and the 1994 peace deal with Jordan. But this apparently wasn't enough because Jordan went on to summon Israel's ambassador Eitan Sirkis for the third time in just 3 months, which is quite astounding, a more formal act of protest by Amman. And if that wasn't enough, in addition to Jordan, there was the US, the EU, the UN, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, and others all issued condemnations of Smotrich's remarks, noting that they fly in the face of efforts at Sharm el-Sheikh over the weekend to try and calm tensions between the sides. One Middle Eastern diplomat I spoke to about this was really quite baffled at how almost every day, he put it, this new government is trying to seemingly intentionally cause diplomatic incidents with Israel's Arab neighbors and what makes it much harder to advance the Abraham Accords.
Another question that I keep on thinking about is, why is Bezalel Smotrich running around so much? He is the finance minister.
When these lawmakers finally get into positions of power, I think a real perk of it is being able to travel the world and I think represent Israel in an official capacity. These trips are mainly supposed to be for meetings with other government officials, not with other Jewish or Israeli groups, which is what this government has had to suffice with, given that so many of its ministers and even Netanyahu herself are being either blackballed or boycotted by various countries abroad.
Right. So, and that's what we've seen. Maybe this trip will be the last for Bezalel Smotrich for a while. Luke, so the protests in Israel against the judicial overhaul, of course, keep on growing in numbers and in locations from week to week. And they're also happening in New York as well. And I believe that they are also growing from week to week. Give us a sense of what's happening and where it's taking place.
Yeah, so there's been a lot happening on the ground in and around New York opposed to the judicial overhaul. So there have been weekly protests on Sundays in New York City and Washington Square Park, and they're getting bigger every week. This weekend, the Sunday protest, the organizers estimated there were 500 people. Also on Sunday, there was a protest in New Jersey against two Otzma Yehudit ministers who were at an event in New Jersey. So two protests on Sunday. They appear to be getting more organized. They're kind of building out this network. It's a lot of Israeli expats who are in these groups. There's been like some kind of separate events for more Jewish Americans who are not Israeli. There's also been visits from people opposed to the overhaul. Labor lawmaker Gilad Kariv was in New York this weekend. He went to the Sunday protest. He spoke to some Jewish communities, met with some Jewish congressional lawmakers from New York City to speak to them against the overhaul. And then there was three actually Otzma Yehudit members in the New York City area this weekend. Also, one of them was speaking about the overhaul. The two others were kind of doing something unrelated. But they drew a protest outside their event in New Jersey. Last week, there was also a delegation of these high-level reservists from the IDF who were here. They were also meeting lawmakers, also speaking to Jewish communities, and also attending these protests to raise awareness and kind of drum up support against the overhaul in the diaspora.
Now, I know there's also comments being made by rabbis. For instance, you have a piece about Rabbi Emil Hirsch, who spoke about the judicial reform in his synagogue, correct?
Yeah, so Rabbi Ami Hirsch, he's at the Stephen Wise Free Synagogue in Manhattan. He's one of the, I would say, strongest pro-Israel voices in the reform movement. He's a prominent rabbi, and he's very supportive of Israel. So he made a big speech on Friday during services. He said it was one of the most painful he's ever done, the most painful sermon in his career. And he said it's kind of necessary to debate the balance of power in Israel, which is what the government is kind of saying this is about, the balance of power between the legislative and executive branches and the judiciary. He says that's necessary, but he says it's going too fast. The way they're doing it, he said, is tearing Israeli society apart and bringing world Jewry along. And he said some of these far-right ministers in the government, he said, they distort Judaism and are an embarrassment to the Jewish people. And he vowed to continue always supporting Israel, but really strong words from this very prominent pro-Israel rabbi against this government.
We're going to take a quick break. When we're back, Jacob will talk to us about what President Joe Biden had to say to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about the judicial overhaul.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
Jacob, tell us, what was the substance of this phone conversation between the two leaders?
Right. So President Biden called Netanyahu on Sunday to express his concerns regarding the judicial overhaul effort. This is just the second call that they've held since Netanyahu returned to power. So it's been a few months. And I don't think it was a topic that Netanyahu was probably hoping to discuss. And if you look at the readouts that the two offices held or issued, Netanyahu's readout said that they mainly spoke about Iran. And then the Biden readout was like 80% about the judicial reform. And it was almost as if Biden gave this lecture or lesson to Netanyahu about the importance of democratic institutions and civil liberties and all these sorts of things that you would think Netanyahu knows about. But Biden felt that he needed to reiterate. He talked about, according to one official I spoke with, the importance of trying to get some sort of consensus for anything that that Netanyahu is trying to pass and not do it with this narrow majority that seems to be the case as of late. And then also, Biden talked about his interest in Netanyahu going along with, President Herzog's, compromise efforts and that being the framework for what the sides should really be working on as opposed to something more extreme, which is what the government is trying to pass. Netanyahu, in turn, said that he basically tried to assure him that he's working to address the matter responsibly and that, he doesn't want to try to overcorrect what he views as a current imbalance between the powers. But at the same time, he's asking for time and space to carry out these reforms. And what I understood was a hint to Biden and others abroad to stop, quit publicly condemning these efforts and give Netanyahu the space to do what he wants, which is an interesting strategy. The other tidbit I heard from the call is that Biden told Netanyahu that in all of his years involved in U.S.-Israel relations, he's never seen domestic apprehension in the U.S. toward Israel as high as it is right now. So I guess he's really taken aback, and I think it's what contributed to this decision to have a phone call about something that I think Biden would rather not really discuss at this moment.
Right, and presumably there weren't any invitations issued to Netanyahu to come visit D.C.
Right, that was the question a lot of us had in a briefing afterwards on the call. And Biden officials were polite about saying, well, we'd love to have a face-to-face meeting between the two leaders. They get along so well, but we didn't discuss it. It's just an issue of scheduling, and I wouldn't read into it too much, but it's not about reading into it. It's clear at this point that the Biden administration is not interested in giving Netanyahu I think what is seen as like a diplomatic gift of FaceTime at the White House right now, given the conduct of his government.
I guess I'll have to wait and see how much Bibi wants to get to the White House. Okay. Now, the U.S. was also involved in these meetings that were held in Sharm el-Sheikh, also attended by Israel, Jordan, and Egypt, and the Palestinian Authority, correct?
Right. So this was the second meeting that the parties have held in just as many months. The last one was in Aqaba. And this one seemed to be largely a regurgitation of what was hashed out there. Both times the sides issued this joint communique where they expressed their commitment to de-escalating tensions before the month of Ramadan, which starts on Thursday and has always been a time of further tensions and violence over the past few years. I think the new parts that came out of this summit was this, in the communique, it highlighted the legal right of the Palestinian Authority to exercise its security responsibility over Area A of the West Bank. And this is the area that it's roughly 20%. And according to the Oslo Accords, this is where the PA has total security and civilian control. But Israel regularly enters Area A and has done so in exceedingly high rates over the past year to clamp down on terror activity. And these raids that we've been seeing in Jenin and Nablus that have taken place sometimes on a daily basis have really led to high death counts on the Palestinian side and been a cause for concern amongst leaders who are fearing that it'll only further escalate violence and tensions. So the effort in Sharm el-Sheikh was to try to get the Palestinian Authority to take more control in Area A, where they've lost control given their waning popularity, high levels of corruption, and Israel basically saying, we're happy to stay away from Area A as long as the Palestinian Authority can act against these armed groups that have been sprouting up there. So there was an interesting commitment there from both sides to try to see that goal. The PA, on the other hand, does argue that it's harder for it to cooperate with Israel's security measures if there's no other avenue where there's also cooperation, be it on the political or the security realm. So there was a couple of mechanisms that were, or committees that were created at the Sharm el-Sheikh meeting, where one is on economic and one is on security, so still not political, but still a step toward it, where they work to boost security and economic ties and improve the Palestinian Authority's stature and the economy of the Palestinians more broadly. And there was a commitment to reconvene again next month and possibly once a month in the months coming, in the months ahead as well. So there at least is this platform for the sides to continue meeting, which hasn't happened before. These kinds of meetings haven't happened in years. So there is some reason for optimism on that front. But at the same time, during the meeting, there was another terror attack in Hawara. Smotrich's remarks the next day, the Israeli government passing this legislation canceling the disengagement law in the northern West Bank, which is a whole other issue that Palestinians view as a further escalation. So I wouldn't say there's a lot of room for optimism, but there is this new format for the sides to continue talking.
Right, and we'll see how these first days of Ramadan go. Okay, finally, Luke, let's talk about Ben & Jerry's. So back in 2021, Ben & Jerry's said it was going to stop selling its ice cream in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, saying that sales in the territories sought by the Palestinians for a potential future state were, quote, inconsistent with our values. Now the Vermont ice cream maker is being sued for child labor, which doesn't really seem to jive with its social mission. What can you tell us about all of this?
Yeah, so Ben & Jerry's has been in this long controversy over Israel, which it says is part of its social mission, which is a key part of its identity, and it says a key part of its business strategy. So they said they were boycotting the occupied Palestinian territories as part of that mission. And it was seen as prejudiced because they don't really get involved much in foreign issues. Like they take a stand on domestic stuff, but it's kind of seen as they were like singling out Israel for this protest against the settlements. So that case wrapped up in December. And then a few weeks ago, it came out in a New York Times report that Ben & Jerry's suppliers were using child labor, along with a lot of other corporations.
Right. I was just going to note that was a big piece that talked about a lot of corporations dealing with that issue.
Yeah, a lot of corporations, a lot of it is through their suppliers and staffing agencies, but the corporations essentially know what's going on in most cases. Some of it's legal, some of it's illegal, but it's dangerous work. It's really grueling for these kids who are vulnerable for the most part. It's keeping a lot of them out of school. So Ben & Jerry's was one of the companies whose suppliers was doing this, which jumped out because they have this social mission and commitment to helping vulnerable people and progressive causes. And a spokesperson for Ben & Jerry's kind of acknowledged it to the New York Times. They said, if kids are going to work, they should work in a well-monitored workplace, and our workplaces are well-monitored. So it was just kind of really didn't sit well with the rest of their mission. So in response to that, they have now been sued in New York in a federal court, a class action lawsuit saying they misled consumers about their social commitments, because they said, we as consumers were buying this ice cream and paying a premium because we support their social mission. And now it turns out, in at least this case, they're really not doing what they said they will do. And so it's also, it would be legal for them in many instances to use child labor in Vermont, in dairy production. According to Vermont laws, in a lot of instances, they can use child labor. But they have said in the past that they didn't already. They filed official documents saying, we don't use child labor and our suppliers do not use child labor. So they contradicted their own position about this. So it's seen as hypocritical. Like, I spoke to the lawyer for Ben & Jerry's Israel, who had this involved in this big battle. It's kind of Ben & Jerry's Israel and Unilever, which is Ben & Jerry's parent company, and Ben & Jerry's. They're saying it's hypocritical because the Ben & Jerry's board, which is tasked with protecting its social mission, has put all these resources into the Israel issue. Like they sued their own parent company over this Israel issue. And the board has been totally silent on their own use of child labor. And the Ben & Jerry's put out a statement after the New York Times article came out, and they said, "We oppose child labor." They didn't deny that they use it or that they knew about it.
Or what they're going to do about it.
Yeah, they said, "We oppose it," basically, without saying anything concrete. And I asked Ben & Jerry's if this was attributable to the board, and they said no. So the board, which is independent, has been totally silent on this. And the board's chair has continued to post online about Israel stuff all the time. So it's just kind of seen as this, like with Ben & Jerry's and a lot of other progressive stuff, it's just kind of seen as part of this bigger one-sided focus on Israel and kind of turning a blind eye to other stuff.
And it's an imbalance that is basically sort of built into the corporate strategy, so to speak.
To me, it reminds me of like Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, a lot of the UN stuff. It's just kind of this lopsided focus on Israel in a lot of these progressive circles.
Ben & Jerry's Israel Now is a separate company, as I've understood it. In other words, it is related, but essentially operates independently of Ben & Jerry's International, so to speak.
Broad strokes, Ben & Jerry's Israel sued Unilever over this. They reached a deal to spin off Ben & Jerry's Israel into its own thing, which is now totally independent. They use the branding, but only in Hebrew and Arabic. In response to that, Ben & Jerry's sued Unilever. So it's just this almost two-year-long, like, huge convoluted legal battle about this.
And which is not over, you're saying?
What essentially was a pretty minor thing. I mean, the new thing is it's kind of separate. It's so in the same court in New York during the Israel battle, they were saying this social mission is a key part of our business and that's why we're protecting it in court and all this stuff. So in the same court, they're getting sued for contradicting themselves. But aside from that, it's just kind of seen as hypocritical and contradictory. It's not part of the same continuous legal battle.
Got it. Okay. Interesting nonetheless. Thank you, Luke. Thanks to both of you for being on today's Daily Briefing. It was good to have you here.
Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks, Jessica.
We will be back tomorrow with another Daily Briefing. In the meantime, have yourselves a good day and take care.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. And thanks to our producer, Gilad Brownstein, and to Gili Amar for this out-of-this-world music.
You can find us daily wherever you find your podcasts.
And on our mothership, timesofisrael.com. Like what you hear? Consider rating us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify to spread the word.
Until next time,
Shalom.